In the counterculture of the 1960s, LSD was the hippie sacrament. My guest, Jay Stevens, has written a history of LSD. Its role in the rise and fall of the counterculture is only part of the story. Stevens traces the history of the synthetic drug from its creation in 1943. He describes the LSD experiments conducted in the 1950s by the psychiatric profession and by the CIA. And he looks at the people who first began experimenting with the drug as a way to alter consciousness. It wasn't until 1962 that the Food and Drug Administration began to regulate the use of LSD. Stevens calls 1966 the year America woke to the gravity of the psychedelic movement. That year, three congressional committees investigated LSD, and California passed a bill criminalizing the drug. Jay Stevens' book is titled Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. It's just come out in paperback. I asked Jay Stevens if it was difficult to research the subject of LSD since its usage was illegal and underground.
The real answer is probably yes or no. It was difficult in the sense that the people that were involved with it are fairly close-mouthed about it now because it ended so badly. And they're scattered widely. Many of them, many of the people that were involved in the 50s, the therapeutic community, are now in their 70s or 80s. So in that sense, you had to travel around, you had to dig them out, you had to, in a sense, gain their trust and be passed along.
And yeah, people think you were a narcotics agent when you came questioning them?
No, what the, a couple did, yes. Most of them really felt that they had been so misrepresented, certainly the early therapists and the hippie leadership. They had been misrepresented, and so they were suspicious. You came in with the black mark of a reporter on you, and you sort of had to say, well, prove to us that you're a nice guy. And once you sort of had, once they'd sort of vetted you, then they'd say, oh, well, you must talk to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And that's really the way it went around. It was easy in one sense because a lot of people involved with it really felt that they were involved with a story that was one of the major ones of the 20th century, let's say, a peculiar story about really an attempt to explore man's unconscious and possibly get in touch with this, higher spirituality. And so they kept everything. There was a man, Oscar Janiger, a psychiatrist close to the Huxley crowd. Early in the 60s, he decided that this, what he was involved with, was a resounding story, and so he began tape recording everyone. And so you had these archives that a lot of people kept. Kesey kept everything, every scrap of every napkin that they ever wrote on in an acid test is in his archives. Leary had people around him that were assiduous archivists. And this kind of helped because the nature of the story, taking a lot of psychedelic drugs in the 60s, one of the downsides of the drug is sort of a problem with short-term memory.
That's right.
So in terms of being a historian, it was really helpful that there were the archivists out there.
You're 32, so I figure you came of age at the tail end of the psychedelic period. What was your personal interest in researching the subject of LSD?
Well, I came of age at the end of the 60s with its shadow sort of on me, and I was always fascinated by the period, and I really wanted to write a book, and through a number of circumstances, suddenly I focused on the psychedelic movement, and the more I looked at it, the more fascinating and interesting it became. One reason was because the story I thought I knew was not what had happened at all, really. I had sort of absorbed a number of myths and rumors, and that was not really what had happened. And then is it, you know, where? What other story could you have? God, the CIA, G. Gordon Liddy, Tim Leary, the hippies, Harvard professors, all sort of crowding in between the margins. I fell in love with the story.
Did you feel that as part of your research you had to either do LSD for the first time, or if you'd done it before, do it again and get a direct sense of the experience?
Yeah, I sort of felt, that you couldn't write about China without going there. And when I started doing, I had done probably I don't know, probably a lot of my generation, I had tried these drugs in the early 70s, and I took them in a fairly, you know, you'd go look at the ocean or you'd go to a rock concert, somebody would say, here's a pill, take this. And at that time, you actually did. You look back on it now and you're a little horrified of all the things you put in your system. But anyways, I had done it then, and when I started researching the book, a number of the psychotherapists involved with it in the 50s sort of said, you have to take this drug, and you let us show you what we used to do with it. You know, if you read the therapeutic literature, there were claims made that, you know, they could take you to areas of experience that looked like past lives, or, you know, the classic one, you know, to the pure void, the cosmic meaning at the center of all. You could wander into that room. Leary called the mind that you found under LSD the land of 10,000 rooms. And a lot of these guys said, hey, we have maps. We can tour you around. And
Would you describe what that trip was like, or the series of trips which you took with the guidance of some of the people who were leading the trips back in the early days of psychedelic drugs?
This was one of the... we can talk about content. We'll talk about... I guess let's talk a little bit about the form. One of the problems that psychedelic therapy had within the therapeutic community was because of the way a guided trip looked like. What they would do is usually they would mask all the senses because they want you to go inside. They want you to go into your unconscious. And so they would mask all the senses. They would usually start off with their certain pieces of music by Bach that when you hear them, you realize, you know, this man was writing about a mystical experience. I mean, it seems implicit in the music. And that kind of carries you up and gets you into the state. And then, you know, they guide you with pictures. There is one moment where... they bring out a clear diamond, a pure diamond, and you look into the diamond, and the only way to describe it is you sort of leap over, sort of leap across the canyon, and you're into another area of the unconscious. If you start having problems, there are various tactile things that they do that's very calming. What it's very similar to, actually, is what might be called classic shamanic technique. And this was a problem for the therapists in the late 50s when they started saying, I don't know why blowing smoke in the face of a person who's having problems with this drug works, but it works. Or I don't know why this picture of Goya's, some of Van Gogh, had a little bit of this state, why looking at these flowers will move them into a different area of the mind, but it does. And so using a lot of these peculiar cues, they could sort of move you around. Say, well, let's go see what's in your personal unconscious, and you're back there sort of experiencing something that happened to you when you were two.
Well, very briefly, did this experience that you had put you in the right frame of mind to continue the research on your book about LSD?
Sure. It made me... Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. yes.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the research that you've done and some of the history that you've uncovered. LSD was first synthesized in 1943 by a research chemist named Dr. Albert Hofmann working in Switzerland. What was he trying to create?
He was looking for... Well, in the early days of the pharmaceutical industry, they were looking for anything that would work. But he was specifically looking for a migraine headache cure, something for headaches, a pain reliever. And he was working with Ergo that had proved that they'd gotten a number of drugs out of it. And so he was continuing that project. And he discovered LSD.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Jay Stevens, and he's just written a history of LSD. It's called Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. LSD entered American culture through two very different areas. One is through psychiatry, which was using it as a therapeutic tool, and the other was through the CIA, which was using it in experiments. Let's talk about psychiatry, and then we'll get to the CIA. What were some of the uses that in the early 50s, psychiatrists saw for LSD?
Well, there were really two schools. the first school, which in a sense, if you think about it, are connected. LSD was really seen as that psychotherapy had finally found the key into the unconscious. It unlocked that locked door, and you could go in and rummage around. Now, certain people thought that the unconscious, well, what happened when you got there was the location of crazy behavior. So one group of therapists and researchers mainly used it to create what they called psychotic breakdowns. They really thought, this is a drug where we can use it to make people experimentally crazy, and we'll discover what craziness is. And so you had these people using it to drive people crazy in laboratory situations, and they called it a psychotomimetic. LSD in the early literature was known as a psychotomimetic. Another group of therapists, though, were using it because they discovered that if you gave somebody a small amount of LSD and then you started them through the very traditional therapeutic sort of questioning, they seemed to have access to their unconscious fears, their anxieties. They seemed to get there a lot faster. So they thought, we're looking at something that will speed up the therapeutic process. You'd have people saying, you know, a lot of papers were written where therapists said, you know, I did in 3 months what used to take me 3 years. So those were the two uses within the therapeutic community. Now, do you want to get to the CIA?
Yeah, no. The CIA started experimenting with it in around 1953. What were they trying to do?
The CIA had inherited from the Nazis, and, well, I suppose all of the intelligence agencies around the country, around the world, had really started looking for a mind control drug. And the CIA was very energetically examining all kinds of possibilities, and when I think they were first attracted not to the therapeutic possibilities of LSD but to the madness possibilities, when they said, here's a drug that'll temporarily drive people crazy, they thought, possibly this is a drug that will allow us to control their minds as well. So they were, you know, they very early on got onto the psychedelic family of drugs and sort of paralleled the therapy community in their search for it. They, you know, were used psilocybin, mescaline, all kinds of substances in their search.
Well, in a moment, I want to talk to you about some of the people who brought LSD out of experimentation into American culture. But first, we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Jay Stevens. He's the author of the new book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Jay Stevens is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream. Jay, let's talk about three of the people who you compare, three of the people who helped popularize LSD. Aldous Huxley, the writer, Timothy Leary, who started off as a professor at Harvard University, and Ken Kesey, who was a novelist who played a big role in popularizing the drug. Let's start with Huxley. He started experimenting with LSD in 1953. What was his vision of what LSD could do?
Huxley really felt, he was the best way to put it is Aldous Huxley was heir to a desire among a lot of Western intellectuals dating back to about the 1880s that a way could be found to accelerate human evolution. Now, what's that mean? To Huxley, it didn't mean, and to most of the people that bought into this belief, didn't mean that you'd get taller or anything like that. They really believed you'd get more conscious. As a matter of fact, the phrase cosmic consciousness was coined in 1900 to sort of indicate the evolutionary stage beyond self-consciousness. And it was coined by a Canadian, Richard Buck, and he really felt that people like Buddha and Jesus and a number of the other great mystics were merely like species forerunners of cosmic consciousness. Now, Huxley bought into this about the 30s, and he really felt that, particularly after World War I, and very greatly after the discovery of atomic fission, that a way had to be found to accelerate human evolution. And he really spent, from about 1930 to 1953, a lot of his time went for searching for a way to get access to this cosmic dimension that the great mystics seemed to have access to.
Through his writing, he made some of the intellectuals aware of these kinds of drugs. Let's compare his view to Timothy Leary's, who played a greater role in democratizing LSD and making it available to larger groups of people.
Well, Aldous ran into mescaline and then LSD in the early 50s. And, okay, here you have, you've had a desire to accelerate human evolution and you've discovered what you think might be the appropriate tool. What do you do? Huxley really felt what you did is you turned on the cultural, political, and scientific elite of the world, that these were the people that really changed cultures, that led people in new directions. And so he really spent the last 10 years of his life trying to interest these people in taking it and sort of trying to get people to research the spiritual aspects of it. And Tim Leary was, in a sense, I mean, if you want to use a crude word, recruited by the Huxley crowd, because Tim was at Harvard, and a lot of members of the world elite pass through Harvard in any given year. Now, Tim differed on how you might change a culture or change man's evolutionary curve. Tim really felt you didn't turn on older people that had their categories intact. What you did is you turned on the kids. You turned on the people who were still open to all life's possibilities. He also felt that everybody should be able to have this experience. Not, you know, you didn't need a PhD from Harvard in order to take LSD, that everybody should be able to take them, provided you were carefully guided. Tim would recognize that, you know, going into your unconscious could be very dangerous, so you needed a guide. And so Tim really said, well, you know, we will train guides, and every young American can have this experience. He'll just call up his neighborhood guide, look him up in the Yellow Pages, psychedelic guide, call him up and say, I want to take a trip.
Well, you suggest that Ken Kesey, with the trips festivals, and with his wide dissemination of LSD, took away some of those controls, and maybe by doing so made it more possible for people to have bad trips.
Yes. What really happened was the Huxley people were horrified when Tim sort of ran away in his direction, and Tim really felt everybody could have a good trip provided they were carefully guided. Ken Kesey really felt that controls weren't the point. They got in the way. The point was to freak freely, as they used to put it, to sort of, like, can you pass the acid test? It was a very macho ethic, really. You know, can you go and hang over the edge by your toes and not fall in a sense? And he also felt that it was a part. He saw the party aspect to it. All these other people were, you know, even the Leary people were sort of running around, still in the spiritual aspect. Kesey, you know, really saw the party aspect, and he began throwing increasingly large parties where, well, anyways, you can see that's a. These two philosophies sort of met, and I think the meeting of them was disastrous. Tim's sort of saying, everybody can take this drug, everybody should take this drug, and Ken Kesey sort of saying, you don't need any controls to do it. Take it and have fun, and if you go crazy, well, you didn't pass the acid test. And that sort of was the making of a lot of the badness that came out in the late 60s.
You know, where do you think that the whole psychedelic dream started to go bad?
I think it started to go bad in late 66, probably. I think that it had, you know, I start my book with the gathering of the tribes for the first human being, and that was sort of, in a sense, that's the climax of my book. I go back, it's the sense, that's the highest moment, and it's all downhill from there, though it's going to take about, that was in January 67. It's going to take about till July before the people realized that, you know, they had almost grasped whatever it was they were seeking to grasp, and that they'd slipped. Somehow it had eluded them. So I'd say the middle of 67, it began to go very bad for a number of reasons.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of people who were doing psychedelic drugs in the 1960s and in the early 1970s discounted a lot of the warnings that parents, government officials, and the press were giving.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason why I think they were discounted was because they were extreme warnings, and also because the warnings were given from people who didn't understand at all why people were doing these drugs in the first place. Do you think that that's a fair assessment?
I think that's absolutely correct. One of the curious things about the area of anti-drug I don't want to say propaganda, but in a sense, that's sort of what it is. Is if and you can go back to start and look at the Reefer Madness stuff of the 30s.
Well, people used to get stoned and go watch that movie. That was supposed to be a cautionary film about
marijuana.
That
was a cautionary film.
But that was
film.
Really how it was used source of entertainment.
If you read a lot of the Reefer Madness stuff, it was, okay, smoke a joint and you'll rape your sister and kill your mother and then commit suicide. And all anyone had to do, and they started doing it in the 50s, was smoke one joint and see that that didn't happen and sort of say, hey, this isn't bad. And, you know, the whole anti-message was lost. My feeling was that, you know, they weren't straight with the kids. And in a sense, what you had in the late 60s was two propaganda wars. You had Tim Leary saying, take LSD and you'll have 10,000 orgasms. And you had the establishment, or whatever you want to call it, the cultural powers that be saying, if you take this drug, you'll go crazy. And what happened was a lot of kids seemed to be saying, if what you have is sane, then give me crazy. So they escalated the battle, and within the propaganda war, when they came up with the genetic damage argument, which was, perhaps you've heard of that, that if you took LSD, it would damage your chromosomes. Within the scientific community, that was widely belittled, the actual research protocol, the way the guy designed his experiment. But, you know, at the sort of media surface of things at Time Life, New York Times, it was given wide play. And I think that in that sense, they won the media game, because the idea that to take the risk yourself was one thing. To pass it down through the generations, it was sort of a very cool wind that swept through the psychedelic movement. Also because, let me give you another reason, the hippies were very fond of the idea that they were mutants. They really bought into the whole notion that they were the evolutionary curve of the species were changing, and they were the mutated species.
The freaks.
They preferred freaks and heads. And if you've bought into that, and then somebody comes along and says, you really are, or actually your kids are going to be freaks, it came at them, and it's the last thing they expected. And you can sort of, if you go back and read the history, you can see the convulsions that went through the period.
Does anyone do LSD anymore? Is there much of it available? Is there a market for it?
Actually, the only statistics you really have, I'd say there's more LSD being used probably today. If you go by the accounts that are showing up in newspapers, than has been in the last few years. But the only way the government really has of testing these things is they give a survey to high school kids called the National Institute of Drug Abuse Survey, and the figures have been about very constant from the late 60s right up till now. About 10% of the kids in high school use psychedelics or have used them. So if that's any indication, it remains among a small group a very still a potent force. Whether they're using them to gain access into a higher consciousness, I tend not to think so. I tend to think that they're using it like it's like a fast car.
One last question. Do you see any connection between the rise of the use of cocaine and designer drugs with the psychedelic movement of the 60s? Is there any comparison to be made?
It used to... to people that bought into the vision that this was going to change consciousness, when they saw the hippies in the Haight-Ashbury start using speed, start using heroin, it just blew their minds. And I think, LSD created, and a lot of drugs have created an appetite for sensation, and a lot of the people that used them, maybe 2 out of every 5 or 3 out of every 5 who used them back then, were simply using it, as I said earlier, it was like a fast car. Cocaine's a better sensation. I mean, LSD, you took it, you were gone 12 hours. You really couldn't hold a job if you did LSD a lot. Cocaine, you can hold a job and still have a nightlife. I think that it played a part, and it has certainly got a lot of kids that wouldn't have gone in that direction into looking for more and more intense sensations.
But without the pursuit of the more mystical.
Right. Vision. I mean, in the sense of, in a pharmacological sense, I mean, cocaine and LSD are very different drugs. They do different things to the body. They have, there are different pleasures. There are different downsides involved. But in the fact that they're a drug, they're a illegal drug, and a drug subculture arose that looked at these things, they're related. And I think the cocaine epidemic that came out is one of the you know, as Huxley would say, it's simply, you know, we haven't gone about this intelligently yet.
You did a little bit of LSD when you were younger. Do you regret it at all now? Do you regard it differently now after having written this book than you did when you were doing it at the time?
Yes and no. You know, at the time it was fun, and one of the nice things about one of the hard things about writing the book in the Just Say No generation is you run into saying, well, one of the nice things about taking LSD, and you say, my God, how is that going to sound? What are they going to think? Anyways, one of the nice things about taking LSD when you're young is suddenly the world seems alive. You know, you're looking at a tree and you're saying, whoa, that tree is really alive. And it's probably nice to do that when you're about 18 or 19, I think, to suddenly rediscover that there's nature out there, that you're living in a living world. And this is something that happens to almost everyone that did the drug. To use it sort of so foolishly, well, Huxley used to feel, and I suppose if anybody, I've come to adopt his perspective, that it was really best for people in their 30s because they, you know, because they sort of had stable egos. You know, they were less impassioned about life. They were sort of in the midpoint of the journey, and that was a good time to reflect upon the big question. So I don't regret it, no. But on the other hand, I sort of look back and I say, well, I didn't do it intelligently. And then yet, you know, you also say, well, when I was 19, I wasn't that intelligent anyways.
Jay Stevens, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Jay Stevens' book, Storming Heaven, LSD and the American Dream, has just been published in paperback by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.